Squad, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to the latest movie in the DC Extended Universe, the DCEU, and it is, of course, Captain Marvel. No. Shazam! And joining me to find out what songs you're listening to over the next hour or so is a trio of wonderful Shazammers. I'm joined by John Nugent.
Hello.
Ben Travis.
Hello.
And Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Welcome all. How are you?
You know.
Yeah.
No, I'm good. I'm wearing my Shazam top.
Kind of. Yes.
Very nice.
Was that intentional?
No, I just put on a top this morning and left the house and then suddenly thought, huh, there's a lightning bolt in the front of this. This is extremely appropriate. Well done.
I mean, indeed. This is a podcast, so am I. I'm wearing a Shazam top. You've got no proof.
You, sir, are a liar.
I'm not wearing a Shazam top, but my underpants do have a kind of lightning-style streak on them.
Oh, God.
I'm just going to leave it up to you to decide what that is.
No.
It's like the Turin Shroud.
Oh,
if you stared it long enough.
What?
Please stop.
Or is that Magic Eye? Anyway.
Oh.
We're talking Shazam, the family-friendly favourite from the DCEU. But before we get into the film, spoilerific, third act stuff, all the usual kit and caboodle, let's hear from the people who made it. A couple of weeks ago, the director of the film, David F. Sandberg, and the producer, Peter Safran, came in to talk about the movie, and I sat down and had a good old spoilerific chat with him. So, yes, we go spoilerific right from the off. So, if you have not seen Shazam, as ever, this is a spoiler special podcast. Stop listening. Go see Shazam and then come back. All right? Fair enough? Excellent. Here you go. David F. Sandberg and Peter Safran having a good old chat with me. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on this very, very special Shazam spoiler special. Put your own exclamation mark in there if you want to. By the director of the film, David F. Sandberg, and the producer, Peter Safran. How are you both?
Doing great.
Doing fantastic.
Big fan
good
of your podcast.
You.
So.
Oh, come on now. Let's start the old Mutual Appreciation Society getting a bit early here. This is good. I like to start spoiler specials with the big question, the question that's on everybody's lips, which is, at any point in the film, did you toy with using the words Captain Marvel at any point during the montage, for example, where Shazam is given a whole bunch of different names?
Not really, because we knew that the other Captain Marvel was coming out almost in the same month, so which is hilarious. But to us it was like, let's not even go there, because we can have fun with it in so many other ways.
And of course, we did have Captain Sparkle Fingers, which some people have suggested might be a nod to another movie. Yeah. But no, that was, it just made sense. His fingers were sparkling. Why wouldn't he be Captain Sparkle Fingers?
What sort of list did you have drawn up of alternative superhero names?
Limitless.
Yeah.
Hundreds.
Hundreds.
Yes.
So many.
Yes.
What we do with these things is that we tend to start at the end and then work our way back into the film. And the end of the film is fascinating to me. Not the post-credits things. We'll get to those in a minute. But the other members of Billy Batson's foster family become heroes in their own right. Two of those heroes are played by Adam Brody and DJ Katrina.
I see where you're going with this.
You see where I'm going with this. Who were both, at one point, meant to be in George Miller's Justice League.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's not a coincidence, surely, is it?
It is, actually. I had no
idea.
Really
we're casting really is.
Him. Really?
It was one of those things where afterwards, it was like, oh, right, okay, yeah, that's cool. Because, now you get to actually be superheroes on screen this time.
And this film is about wish fulfillment, and it ultimately fulfills DJ's and Adam's wish to put on superhero outfits and be superheroes. So it was incredibly satisfying for them to be able to do it. But the truth is, they just were the best guys that auditioned for those particular roles. And then once we were in there, like, holy shit, these are George Miller superheroes. This is awesome.
That's amazing.
And they actually didn't know that they were even auditioning for superheroes. Like they knew that they were auditioning for Shazam, but to keep things under wraps, we had Henry, he wrote scenes that were just random scenes, but reflected the types of characters we were after. So, like Megan's scene, I think she was with a driving instructor and freaking out. And, just everyday scenes, but that really reflected their characters.
And they were thrilled when they discovered that the role they came in and read for and they got was ultimately the adult superhero. So yeah. They didn't even know going in. Yeah. And it was pretty awesome. I must say, it's incredibly hard and uncomfortable for me to talk about this. We've spent so long not revealing this stuff.
Yeah, I know.
And to be talking about it before the movie even comes out is incredibly disturbing and goes against every fiber of my being.
Honestly, this is a very common thing with these spoiler specials. By the end of it, you will be unburdening yourself.
Sure.
You will be
like, telling family secrets and everything. Precisely.
I want to tell you my PIN number. Yeah. I want to tell you my bank account number and sword code.
Okay.
So once you knew that Adam and DJ were former members of the possible Justice League at one point, did you think about maybe going back and casting some more members of that film? Common, for example, or Megan Gale.
Who was Armie Hammer.
Or Armie Hammer,
of
course.
He's a buddy. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Why not? We'd love to have him in the movie.
Get him on board.
Yeah, I didn't think he wouldn't be so great for an older Darla. I think it would have been tough.
He has range.
Yeah, no, he does. I don't want to limit him, but I think that would have been a tough call.
Before we started talking, we were talking off mic, and David, you were saying that you'd listened to the Chris McQuarrie podcast, and that was very revelatory in a way, because he talks about how fluid the process can be of making a big movie like this.
I mean, it is. I mean, that sounded perhaps a little bit more chaotic than ours, because we had our script from the beginning.
Yeah.
But it's always those things that keep changing, because it's so weird being a director, because you have to try to be really prepared, but you also have to be very adaptable to things and really need to improvise, because you know, in the middle of it is suddenly, okay, this location you can't actually use anymore, or these things won't actually work that way, and you have to continuously come up with new things and figure things out, which is why it's so mentally exhausting to be a director, because your mind is constantly going and trying to look ahead. It's like, okay, what's going to go wrong with this? How are we going to solve this? And and it was fun to listen to that podcast and be like, okay, it's, you know, this is kind of how it is to make movies.
Yeah. And with this one, you said it was pretty much set in stone, I guess, before. The script was pretty much set in stone. Did it undergo any major changes in production? Anything that springs to mind?
Well, we did change some things. Like originally the whole third act took place pretty much only in the carnival, and it felt like we needed to get out there and actually show off Philadelphia. And that was a thing where, you know, in the script, his, you know, we have this scene on the rocky steps in Philadelphia. In the script, that scene was always took place there.
Okay.
But then during the shoot, it was like, we don't really, you know, want to spend the money to go there for just a day or two to do that. Like, let's just shoot everything in Toronto. But then once we had the movie and I showed it to the studio, everyone was like, that scene really needs to be on the rocky steps, because I shot it just on a street corner in Toronto, it wasn't the same thing. But then we were actually able to go to Toronto and actually
go to Philly.
Yeah.
Get some cheesesteak.
Absolutely.
I had a vegetarian's cheesesteak, because I don't eat meat.
That's still embrace the Philadelphia
of course,
world
yeah.
of cheesesteaks.
Should we talk about the last shot of the film, again, post-credits things aside, which is a cameo from a certain Man of Steel, chest of the Man of Steel.
Yes.
Was there any talk at one point about that being Sylvester Stallone, for example?
Stallone? Yeah. No. Yeah.
We tried to get him, and he was like, why me? Yeah.
It's Philly. I'm in Philly all the time.
Yeah.
No one would be that bothered about that. But you do end the film with Shazam palling up with Superman, and there had been talk about at one point about Henry Cavill maybe cameoing in this film. Can you talk about that, and what the truth behind that is, and was the idea always to end with Superman?
The idea was always to end with Superman. That is something we set up throughout the movie. So whether, you know, it's the Briars, the bullies talking about it, and then Superman's gonna, you know, serve us dessert, whether it's, you know, Freddy opening the drawer saying, are you more of a soups guy, and, you know, having the newspapers and the bullet. So we'd always set that up, and that was the intent at the end. We definitely talked about having Cavill come be Superman, but we just couldn't make it work with his schedule. That is, you know, there were a lot of different stories about it, but the truth is we just couldn't make it work. We only had that school where we were shooting for a very specific period of time when the kids were out of school, and it didn't work for him.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the truth is, in the end, it works so much better because it's about the reaction of Freddy. So you really are on Freddy's face rather than on Superman. So, and for us, it was the best. It ended up being the best situation.
And just cutting at that point, you just hard cut to credit, and it's just, it gets a laugh, you know?
It really does.
And yeah, because the original scene was just him sitting down and having a little chat with the kids, basically. And it ended with Freddy saying, like, oh, I have so many questions. Yeah. But I mean, this just turned out.
It was a little bit of a hat on a hat. It was too much. Yeah. This was just the perfect little button and punch at the end.
So if Cavill had done it, there was going to be dialogue. There was going to be, oh, okay, that's interesting. But it finishes on that symbol.
Yeah,
that's
a symbol for hope.
It's a symbol for hope. And the John Williams score is in there as well, which is interesting. Can you talk about that choice?
It's just such a great score. I mean, that was a big inspiration for the sound, that's the score in general. Like to have it feel like, you know, old Amblin movies or like John Williams' Superman, you know, very old school classic superhero score, which I think Ben Walfish really had fun with as well, because it's so unusual to do this type of score these days. So, yeah, he really took that and ran with it.
And if Dick Donner is, you know, the touchstone for all of us and, you know, the tone of the superhero movies that we all grew up loving, it was great to be able to give a nod to that in our film. Yeah.
I've got to ask, who wore the costume in that shot then?
That was David.
Sure. Because I'm sucked in my curtain.
I'm available for sequels. Yeah.
That's good to know. That's good to know. It was actually Zach's stunt double.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Dick Donner, Verissimilitude was a big touchstone for him on the first Superman. I think he even had the word pasted up around the production offices to kind of nail the tone of that movie, which takes something fantastical and grounds it in the real world. And that's something that you do very much here as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a fantastic. So, I mean, we have a wizard in the movie. So, you kind of have to ground it in the real world. Yeah. And that's what makes it so fun. And to me, you know, this was a chance to tap into those movies, you know, that I grew up with and loved, that had that sort of, you know, they had both the fun and the drama and even sometimes a little bit of horror in those kind of 80s movies. To me, it was just a dream to be able to incorporate all of those things.
You do have a horror background.
Yeah.
And that's evident, I think, in the opening sequence of the film, which is pretty scary. Comes out of nowhere as well. Like that car crash at the end comes out of nowhere.
I thought you'd say the boardroom more than beginning.
I'll get to the boardroom in due course. But right from the beginning, I was like, oh, I know the tone you're going for, because there's a Do You Hear What I Hear, which is a song that plays in Gremlins.
Right.
But it's a different version in this movie. And of course, you have John Glover, who is from Gremlins.
Gremlins as well.
So I'm suddenly thinking, hang on, this is Joe Dante. That's what we're going for. That's the tone. And you establish it right from the off with the origin of the villain, which is interesting as well. Can you talk about that also?
Yeah, I mean, we always wanted to have that to really set him up and show that, okay, he had the chance to become Shazam, basically, and he wasn't worthy enough. You know, he wasn't pure of heart, which sends him down a really bad path. Which to me, I mean, you want to set up your villain properly to really know, okay, this is why he wound up that way, and this is what sets him apart from Billy, for example.
Did you always start with Dr. Savannah?
We did. You know. I think, you know, it's an unusual way to tackle a superhero movie is, you know, to not start with your hero. But we thought it was a really interesting way to go, and we knew that, you know, we, obviously a great superhero needs a great villain, and we wanted to give him a proper backstory and really give you a sense of where he comes from before we introduce you to, you know, Mark Strong as Dr. Savannah as an adult. Mm-hmm. It was pretty cool, and it certainly leaned into David's horror background. It really was something that, you know, he delivered in a great fashion, and you know, you get to go from that world into then the magic world of the Rock of Eternity, and then come back out to a really grounded Philadelphia story right afterwards.
And you mentioned the boardroom scene, and I imagine that there were concerns about how far to push that as well, or were you thinking, no, this is we're doing a modern Amblin movie in a way, I guess, and if you look back at the first Gremlins, for example, they get away with all sorts of shit in that film. Yeah. So, were you worried about it or concerned about that in any way, shape, or form?
Not really. I mean, talking to the guys at the studio was basically like, yeah, lean into your horror background, you know, and make them a real threat, the sins. So, you know, when they threaten the family at towards the end, it's like, okay, this is a real threat. And to me, it's like, you know, as long as you don't go full on like gore and blood flying everywhere, you know, you can get away with it because it's like, yeah, it's like Jurassic Park or something like that where, you know, kids love that, but, you know, people get eaten in that movie, you know.
It reminded me a little bit of the first Ghostbusters also. With
that, very much a touchdown.
I mean, for the sins, you know, the demon dogs from Ghostbusters with their glowing red eyes and things like that were a huge inspiration.
Mm. You talked there about setting up Dr. Savannah, and he's interesting because of that boardroom scene and the actions that he takes in that boardroom scene. And he remains throughout the film deadly straight, and this is what he wants. And there's that great joke towards the end where he's making his great speech and he's pontificating. Shazam can't hear a thing he says, which is a gag I've always wanted to see in a film, so well done for that. But otherwise, you play him straight, and the tone of the movie with Shazam and Freddy is different from the movie with Dr. Stefanik.
Yeah, again, I think it's important to have that real threat so you don't play everything lighthearted, or, you know, to have everything goofy, because then you don't feel the stakes.
Trying
to make Savannah's story be a little bit more horror-ish, even going so far as with the score with Ben, it's like, make it a little darker, you know, whenever he's on screen.
But of course you still have a fight in a toy store.
Sure, involving DC characters
in their
stuffed forms.
Which is so awesome to build. I mean, we built that toy store in an actual mall and had it all to ourselves and could destroy and do whatever we want to. And filled with DC toys.
Which you don't have to get clearance for, which is great.
A luxury. It was truly a luxury.
But we were, so it was important to we won't have characters that haven't been introduced in the DC cinematic universe yet. You know, because they had these like toys with like Lex Luthor, and it's like, I don't know if they'd have toys of that guy when he's real, know, like, so we would take those out.
Am I missing any Easter eggs? I've only been able to see the film once so far. There's iconography of Superman and Batman dotted all the way through the film, but are Lewis the two main characters, or is there anything else I'm missing out?
There's a little Watchmen reference in there, and there's some really old school Captain Marvel Easter eggs that only a few people will get, and one of them being Jeff Johns, probably.
There are some relics in the Rock of Eternity that you would have to be a true aficionado to pick up, but they're there.
Okay.
And, you know, they're very evident, but to really know what they are, you know, we had to dig pretty deep.
And there's even a certain creepy doll in the background.
No.
Yes.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
You missed that.
In the pawn shop.
Okay, well, that's it. This is a movie designed for a second viewing.
And a third viewing.
Sure.
Fourth viewing.
We encourage you to do that.
The toy store scene, though, has the brilliant nod to Big. Now, obviously, there's been comparisons to Big all, I guess, from the moment this movie came into being.
Yeah.
That's obviously you leaning into that in a pardon the pun, big way.
Yes. No, I mean, that right from the start. I mean, we were talking about this movie being Big, but with superpowers. Of course, we wanted to reference that in some way and have fun with it.
Yeah, that moment has been in there from the get-go. It was just something that we thought would be incredibly fun to play with.
And afterwards, it's like, oh, shit, we could have had one of those Soltar machines at the carnival, and we missed that opportunity.
I thought you might have that, actually. Stick it in for the Blu-ray.
Sure. Easily doable.
Is there a moment when you had Zachary and Mark Strong doing chopsticks on the piano?
There's B-roll of Zach.
Everyone's playing around.
I think he might have been playing chopsticks, though.
Yeah, I'm sure he was.
I think he was doing that.
That's the way to go.
He's a very talented musician, our Zach.
He strikes me as one of those guys who'd be good at everything.
He can kind of do everything.
Really annoying.
Great singer. Great singer. The ultimate karaoke guy. You want to go to karaoke with Zach Levi. He's sensational.
So we talked about how Dr. Savannah's storyline is very, very straight and has very dark elements as well. I mean, he has his father killed. Interestingly, he doesn't kill his father himself, really. He has a proxy to it. He kills his brother in pretty unceremonious fashion as well. But also the storyline with Billy and his real mother is very dark as well, ends in a surprising fashion. Her rejection of him is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in the comic books, he is an orphan. Like his parents are dead. But when working out the script with, you know, it was a very collaborative process in that we'd get together every week with Henry Gayden and the guys at the studio and Jeff Johns, and we sort of discuss where to go with the script, and then Henry would go off and write pages, and we'd meet up again and talk about it. And at some point, I think it was when Jeff wasn't around, actually, we sort of came up with, well, what if his mom is actually alive? Because that's quite different, you know? Like, it's because, you know, you have a lot of orphans in the superhero world, like Batman and Superman and all these guys. And I remember Jeff sort of reacted when we came back. It's like, oh, so his mom's alive now. But he seemed to be on board with, like, going down that path, even though it went against the old comic books. But yeah, it was something that felt very different and could lead to something very emotional and strong, which I think it did.
But the decision to have her reject him as well, where did that come from? It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's it feels very real, doesn't it? Like, yeah. To have this person who say, like, you know, I'm not ready, this is not a good time for me. Like, she does not have her life put together, you know, and she's not in a good place where she's ready to be a mom.
And it leads into the idea that family is not necessarily about blood, but it is certainly about bond, and that you can find families in unexpected places. And, you know, you would think that him finding his mother, that would be the solution to his problems, but it's not. It's, in fact, the family that he's now with that really provide him with that family that he needed.
Yeah, that moment where he says, like, I have to get back to my real family now. That's sort of when he realized that, okay, I actually have a family.
These people want him, and he wants to be with them.
And was the idea, at what point did the idea come through that his family would also become heroes and become champions?
I mean, that's straight from the comic book. Yeah. And yeah, it was interesting seeing people speculate online about, you know, are they going to do it? No, they're probably going to save that for the sequel. But for us, it was always the big payoff. Like, that was always in the movie, that we wanted to have them all become a super family.
And we knew from the first time we screened the movie, when you see, you know, the five lightning bolts coming through the smoke, and then, you know, here they are in their colorful outfits, and the audience cheers. You know, they cheer and they clap. And we just knew that it was, you know, this incredible payoff for the film. People love it.
And then people like me go, hang on, that's the Flash from Justice League, and that's so
There's no one like you. It's just you. You're the only person saying that.
What's going on? There's lots of debate online every single year. The question is asked, is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Yeah.
And do you think there'll be a debate in years to come? Is Shazam a Christmas movie, or is it just a movie set at Christmas?
Look forward to that. So much debate about that damn Die Hard being a Christmas movie. But yeah, I mean, to me, it is very much a Christmas movie. Because, I mean, not just in that it takes place a Christmas movie, but the theme about family feels very much Christmas-like. But, you know, it's not like we try to play it up too much. Because, you know, it's, you know, partly because it's actually being released in April, so we can't be like, oh, Christmas all the time. But yeah, in many ways, I'd say it's a Christmas movie, something you can watch at Christmas.
And who is that poor Santa Claus you torment throughout the film?
He's a stunt guy from Toronto who was awesome. Like, we tried to, cast actual stunt people with acting talent, like for him and for like all the people in the bus sequence. Those are all stunt guys, and they did a great job with the acting as well, but yeah, that was sort of what we tried to do, to not just cast people and then have stunt people for them, but actually cast really talented stunt people. And we had to go all over Canada and wherever else to find people that could do that.
That bus sequence is very important as well, because it's the moment when shit gets real for Shazam, and it's something he causes well. Was that always the intention in the script, that he has
because that's when he has the falling out with Freddy, you know, that if, you know, we see that he's not doing heroic things. Like, he starts going down this path of someone more selfish, of like just using the powers for his own sake. So that was always the big turning point, where there would be a fallout between him and Freddy, because Freddy is the one who loves superheroes, and he has always dreamed about becoming a superhero, and now he sees his friend get it instead, and he's not using it in the right way.
I've got to wrap it up now, guys, but I've been saying all through this interview that we'd get to the post-credit stings at some point. Let's get to them now. There are two in this. One is obviously a reference to Aquaman, which is a lot of fun. Was that a fairly recent addition? Was that a reaction to the success of Aquaman, or was that always in there?
No, it was always in there. Yeah. It was part of, you know, for the montage and him testing out his powers, it was so much fun coming up with things for him to do that we had way too much we had way more than we could actually put into the movie. And then it was just like, you know, we have these, all these great little scenes. Why don't we take one of them and just put it as a as an end tag? And that that was one of the favorites.
Is there anything else we're missing out? He's trying to see whether he could talk to fish.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a lot. We shot a lot. And I'm sure that you will at some point see those elsewhere. Yeah. But we shot a lot.
Yeah. And some of the things we realized before we shot them that we're not going to be able to fit it all in there. So one was that they fixed the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Yeah. It was like, we can't fit this all in here. We have to start cutting some stuff.
And there were some that were just bad ideas, like the super smell test. But they were still fun to shoot. They were still fun to shoot. Oh, no, it was fun.
It was an elaborate fart joke.
Yes, you know? That's exactly right. You're in. You're in.
I'm totally in.
This is as would most people be.
And then the last thing is that very first post-credits scene. What can you say about that? Who is that talking to Dr. Savannah?
That's Mr. Mind. Evil mastermind who's, the Venusian space worm. he's just a great villain from old school Captain Marvel.
Okay.
And would you like to know whose voice that is?
Yes, please.
David F. Sandberg's.
Yes.
Amazing. So a little nod to where we might go in the next installment.
Yeah, I mean,
with or without Mr. Dwayne Johnson, who knows?
That's right. You never know.
You never know. All right, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, so that was David F. Sandberg and Peter Safran talking about Shazam, and let's now dig into Shazam. First of all, let's go around the table. How do we feel about this movie? A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. For me, it's easily up there with Wonder Woman as the best of the DCEU so far.
Oh, Ben, your innocent naivete is wonderful to behold.
I know that's a relatively low bar that's been set, but I think
Wonder Woman's great.
No, but the non-Wonder Woman ones.
All right, okay.
This is up there with Wonder Woman. I think probably better than Aquaman for me, just because I feel like it has a more consistent tone throughout, whereas which is saying something, because there's still some kind of tonal shifts here, but compared to Aquaman, where it was all the movies happening all the time, I think this had a bit more of a sense of what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to say I liked it. I didn't love it. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a bit cooler than some people.
You're very cool, John.
Oh, you're so cool.
Thank you, yes. Yeah.
You're so cool, Brewster.
No, I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, it's the most I've laughed at a DC movie since Martha and Batman and Superman.
Why'd you say the name?
This time intentionally. It's good fun. It's good fun. I had some issues with it. We'll probably get into that. But overall, I think it's a really likable film, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm sort of in the same boat. I think I'm very positive overall, but I definitely have some issues with it. I think that there were some tonal shifts for me. I think it's interesting because on one hand, I think it's very much a kids' film and very much aimed at a younger audience than, you know, a Batman v Superman, for example. But at the same time, some of the horror in there is a lot more than we would see in most kids' films these days. That is like
horror.
Yeah, that is like 80s kids' film, not naughty's kids film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just, that is interesting that they've gone quite as far as they have in some respects in this film.
Yeah, that start there, in fact. I think it's really interesting, actually. And the opening scene of this movie, and of course the meeting room scene, which I think may become infamous in a weird way for this movie, really took me by surprise. But I, at the same time, they shouldn't have done, because David F. Sandberg has a horror film background, and this is really going for that sort of Amblin vibe. And as you heard in the interview, you know, we talked about Ghostbusters, we talked about Gremlins. I don't think it's an accident that John Glover was cast in the opening scene. I don't think it's an accident that they used Do You Hear What I Hear, which is a Gremlins shout out as well. And whenever I was 7, 8, 9 years old, those movies were my world, you know. And Ghostbusters, I still remember seeing Ghostbusters for the first time. And I've seen many, many horror films since, and very few horror films have shit me up the way that Ghostbusters shat up 8-year-old Chris Hewitt. If I can talk about myself in the third person. If he can talk about himself in the third person, then so can he. And, you know, that moment where the arms rip through the chair and grab Sigourney Weaver, or, you know, even just, you know, the evil thing in the fridge, or
I mean, even just the library ghost. I mean, she doesn't even do anything. That's freaking terrifying.
The library ghost is terrifying.
So scary. Haven't been in a library since.
Yeah.
That's a lie.
You go to the library for an afternoon, clean them out. Have you got anything else? No, we're good. Okay, I'll be back. You're like the locust of libraries.
Do you know what? You know, you jest, but I did get told off for going to the library twice in one day when I was little. And the librarian said, you're not really supposed to come back on the same day. You should probably take out longer books. It was the summer holidays. What was I going to do? Play with friends?
This is how you got into no good. This is how you got up to trouble.
He's like, go out and do some drugs. What are you doing? Trying to expand your mind. Get out. Get out.
No, she just like wanted me to take out longer books so I would not come back morning and afternoon.
All right. Okay.
Anyway.
Anyway, the point is Ghostbusters was terrifying to me as 8 years old and has stayed with me forever. And I think that this movie will serve a similar function for other kids. Mm. And maybe if that becomes a gateway movie to other horror films, then I have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever. And if you're too scared by it, well, this is sorting out the wheat from the chaff, isn't it?
You're a monster.
It's evolution, survival of the fittest.
I mean, in fairness, I think it is a 12A, so they have rated it sort of accordingly. So, you know, people with littler kids probably know what they're kind of getting in for.
Yeah, I saw this for a second time at the weekend with a big kind of Saturday afternoon crowd. And on the row in front of me were some quite small kids who seemed very scared in the scary bits. But I was like, part of me was like, cherish this experience, feel the fear. And I think it balances out really nicely because you get those really scary scenes, but when the laughs come, they're really big. I think the first time I saw the film, I was surprised how divergent the tone was in those moments. But on a second viewing, I think it's just balanced. I think it just balances really nicely that of course the scary bits, you want them to be kind of properly scary to an extent, and when the funny stuff comes, it's really funny. And I think younger viewers, like, I was shit up by Men in Black and The Mummy growing up. Chris is giving me a death stare right now. But those, I remember like seeing Men in Black in the cinema, I think it was maybe 7 or 8, and being terrified. And the same with The Mummy. I think you need those kind of like fearsome experiences, but at the same time they were really funny and exciting.
The Mummy I can get.
Yeah.
Why Men in Black?
Why was I scared of Men in Black?
When he's a bug man.
Vincent D'Onofrio is pulling his skin all over his face.
On my head?
Yeah.
Like this?
And then he pulls it. That moment is burned in my memory. And then when he's the big bug at the end and he's climbing up the tower.
Oh, I thought he just meant Tommy Lee Jones.
Ripped torn.
Terrifying and everything.
Because only to journalists.
Only to journalists, yeah.
I did like, it felt like there was a nod that one of the sins has like big, long, spiky fingers like Diana in Lights Out. I felt like that was a very intentional nod when they're fighting the full Shazam family at the end and there's that shot where it's the hand and then the fingers spike out.
I was trying to figure out this time, I've seen it 3 times now, I was trying to figure out which sins are which. It took me a little while. So I figured out pretty quickly that lust was the one with the tongue. And I agree that lust should probably have been hotter. Pride's the one with the wings, I think. Pride's the tall one with the wings.
Okay.
Wrath, the angry, apey looking one.
Uh-huh.
Greed is the one with 4 arms.
Greed has 4 arms. The ones I had trouble with were sloth and gluttony. So gluttony obviously has the giant mouth and the giant belly, but sloth actually looks quite similar at rest. But what I think sloth has is kind of root arms, which sort of makes sense for the sort of growing roots thing. But that took me a really long time to figure this out, so I just thought I'd share that. And then envy's the weedy one, as he says in the film.
Yeah, I need to see it a couple more times, I think, just to kind of get that the differences between the different the different sins. It's a cool idea, though. It's a fun idea, and I really liked that meeting room scene because it was just like, holy shit.
Wow. He chomped someone's head off.
Oh my word. I thought it was interesting, and I don't think David F. Sandberg and Peter Safran really went for this in the interview, but I thought it was interesting that Mark Strong, his Dr. Evil, he left the killing of his dad up to someone else. But I thought it was interesting, given the psychological trauma and torment that he had suffered at his hands over the years, that I thought maybe he would have taken that into his own hands, so to speak. Anyone else think it was interesting?
Huh.
Just me?
I hadn't really thought.
Just me being a weirdo?
I think at that point, I don't think he sees much of a difference between himself and the sins anymore, maybe.
Yeah.
So it's almost, I mean, he's still an instrument of his will,
I
guess. So
I have to say, while we're on the sins, I felt that was the weakest part for me. I was a little bit disappointed at how sort of generic they looked. It felt like they came a little bit out of a Goosebumps movie or something. I didn't think there was anything that was particularly new or unique about them. So I was slightly disappointed that that was like our big villain. Yeah, the meeting room scene was quite a shock, but I still felt it was...
Yeah.
They could have done something a bit more interesting than just, you know, Mark Strong and some CGI. Not to denigrate Mark Strong's performance.
No, he's brilliant. They look very much like their own statues. Almost a bit of colour might not have gone amiss, actually. Mm. It also would have helped tell them apart at times when they're all fighting together.
Yeah.
it was running towards the end. I was like, oh, they all look different. Oh, they're
no,
all.
No, but seriously, like, that's what I'm saying. It took me three watches of the film to figure out who was who.
It's like the first Michael Bay Transformers movie where you genuinely can't tell the Autobots and the Decepticons apart, which makes the fight scenes quite interesting. Interesting enough, I also thought that they lose their fear factor by the final fight, obviously, which is much more fun and cartoonish, and you know they're all facing off against the different Shazammers. But
it feels like that there are those lines of dialogue at the end, towards the end, where it's Shazam and Savannah, and he's kind of tempting Envy out, where it's like, oh, so I figured out this one is this one and that one is that one, and I felt like that dialogue was probably in addition something to like point out how different they all are, because I think the film could have done a better job of kind of separating out those characters. That it felt a bit on the nose, those lines of dialogue where he's like, oh yeah, so I think like lust was way harder, and
okay. I appreciated that was really helpful in my quest. That was great.
It should have just cut away to each one with a little number one, number two, number three.
Helen filling out her spreadsheet in the cinema. Okay,
why not? That scene also has my favourite moment in the film, which is something I've long wanted to see in a movie like this, which is the moment where Dr. Savannah is monologuing furiously.
Oh yeah.
But Shazam can't hear him, but naturally, because he's at least half a mile away.
That's one of the best jokes.
Yeah,
it's really good. In fact, just as it was leading up to it, I was like, he can't hear him. Of course he can't hear him. And it's like, oh, they've done the joke. Yes. So good. Well done, guys. Before we get into Shazam and Freddy and Billy Batson and everybody and Shazam himself, let's talk about Dr. Savannah, because it's an interesting decision to start the movie with the bad guy's origin.
Yeah.
Aquaman does kind of the same thing. Obviously, it started with Aquaman's origin, but then it goes straight into the bad guy, the secondary bad guy anyway, with Black Manta, and gives him his motivation for the rest of the film. But this movie just goes right away, sets up the universe, sets up the world, sets up the idea of magic and, Jaiman Hansu's wizard and all that sort of stuff, but very much from the bad guy's POV. What did you think of that? And what did you think of Savannah himself through the film? I love Mark Strong, but I feel that they maybe could have given him a little bit more colour and personality.
Mm. That's probably not unfair. I mean, I think I really like them starting with the bad guy for the same reason. I feel like there's a nice symmetry there. You know, it's the same kind of thing that's been attempted in a few superhero movies. I know that hardcore Bat fans object to the Tim Burton approach of kind of that sort of parallel creation between Batman and the Joker.
Yep.
But there's an elegance to that in terms of storytelling. And I think there's an elegance to this as well, that the same sort of incident, the same test, gives you two different outcomes, hero and villain. It seems like a terrible test. It really does. It seems like a really bad system to find a hero. I feel like there should maybe be a preliminary sort of round of some sort. Because again, if you have, I think it's the wizard Shazam telling him he'll never be worthy, and his dad telling him he's a little shit, which is quite shocking in a kid's film, just in itself.
And right from the off as well.
And right from the off, right from that opening scene. I mean, John Glover's already given birth to Lex Luthor. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like he should probably not be allowed to reproduce in superhero movies. It's dangerous. But
and of course, he was in Batman and Robin as well.
Oh my God, I'd forgotten that one. Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not good. This is not good. No, John Glover, we love you, but no.
Oh, he's amazing, but...
I mean, we love him, yeah.
Yeah.
But no.
I like how it kind of addresses how bad the test is, that it gets to the point where the wizard is literally dying and he gets Billy, who's probably the least worthy of anyone he's seen in the last kind of 15 years.
he's like,
it has to be you. It has to be you. This is it.
That's how I got the Emperor job.
I really like the opening scene, I have to say, and I think it did catch me off guard because it's so different to the tone that's in the trailers and all the promos.
Yes.
Mm. I think not just because of the magic thing, but it actually reminded me of the opening to a Harry Potter film, one of the later Harry Potter films, where it's this surprisingly dark and moody and mysterious opening. There was just something about the tone and the atmosphere of it that I really, really liked, and I think I just admire in general how the film takes a little while to get its pieces in place to kind of ground the story and give you the sort of requisite background before getting into the sort of fun Shazam stuff. So I was a big fan of the way that it opened with that scene.
That's interesting, because I struggled with the first act, I've got to say. I found you in the first half hour you basically have two flashbacks, right? You have the flashback for the villain and then the flashback for the hero. And I felt that was a bit clunky. I really thought, oh, come on, when are you going to get going? What are you trying to say here? What's actually the story? Who's the lead here? I totally agree with Helen. I think there is an elegance to having the hero and the villain come from the same place. That's quite a neat sort of storytelling device, and it gives it a sort of nice sort of neat motivation where they're both coming from the same place, but they went down divergent paths. But I just felt the way it just felt a bit like it was taking a little while to find its feet. And and you know, by the end, I think that final act is so much fun. I think it does find its pace, but I did have an issue with the opening.
I mean, it was interesting, the Billy Batson flashback. I like that they had the two sort of versions of that, and that they were only very subtly different. I thought that was really clever, that he remembers it as this sort of idealized thing where she's very loving and very caring. And then you see it sort of from her point of view in the flashback, and she's at the end of her tether and she, you know, is barely hanging on, sort of thing. So I think there's a really nice kind of parallel there. But again, yeah, it does take up a lot of time, and there's so much kind of world building to do with him in the system, going to a new foster home, meeting all his new foster brothers and sisters. I think all of their scenes are super charming. I really, really like them. I would have almost liked to spend a bit more time with the other kids and not just Freddy all the time. But yeah, and then I think there's been a lot of discussion about Billy Batson himself, not least in our own review of the film. There's an odd divide, isn't there, with Billy? Which is, like, he doesn't seem very congruous with Shazam.
Yes.
Because almost everything joyful that happens to him while he is superpowered. And so it feels actually quite disjointed. It doesn't always feel like this is the same kid.
Yeah.
And I think maybe we could have done with a little bit more joyful Billy and a little bit more angry Shazam, in a way, just to kind of make that feel a bit more...
Like there was, it was the same person.
I was trying to watch it with this in mind, and I do feel it tracks as one character. I do, but it's not brilliantly communicated in a visual way.
That's interesting. I don't think it does track as the same character at all. I think, and this never really came up when I interviewed Zachary Levi for the podcast, but Ben, you interviewed him on set,
yes.
I believe,
yeah,
and he said that he almost purposefully didn't really talk to Ash or Angel. This wasn't the John Travolta, Nick Cage type thing from Face Off, where they're studying each other's mannerisms. Not that they really do in that movie, but you know what I mean? That's what they said anyway. Oh, we studied each other, and then, you know, I was him and he was me, and so on and so forth. But it seems to me that Zachary Levi chose not to do that. So he's basically just playing generic 14-year-old guy. In fact, I don't even think he's playing a 14-year-old. He's playing a 10-year-old who's just full of the joys of spring and having all these superpowers. But that's not for me. It's not something that ruins a movie for me or takes me out of it necessarily, but that's not the Billy Batson that we've seen at all.
Although something that did stand out on second watch is that actually the first time you meet Billy, he is kind of doing bad stuff and enjoying it. That scene where he locks the police inside inside the thrift shop to kind of, and then get in the car and he steals the sandwich, and that kind of cheekiness, that side to him, I feel like you don't see that much from Asher Angel in the rest of the film, but it felt like a bit of a link to where Shazam goes, where he's kind of like just doing lightning shows for money and like trying to take selfies with people and get a bit of cash from it and that kind of thing. I noticed a few more links, but I think, yeah, they probably could have done a better job of making those characters feel a bit more connected.
You could also make the argument that if you have superpowers, you're going to be a bit more perky. You
know? Oh, yeah. But that's what I mean. Like, I feel like he is perkier.
Yeah.
And to a fair degree, that's understandable. But again, you still need to tie your two halves together a little bit better than I think they always did.
Yeah, there's no sense that Billy, once he's Billy, has any joy in him, really. And rightly so, because it's quite a fairly heavy-duty storyline they hang upon Billy. I was with you, John, in the first flashback with his mum. I was full of kind of questions of why is this taking so long? But B, also, how does she not find him again? You know, he obviously disappears into the system after that, but it can't be that hard to find her kid. How hard did she look? And I'm glad that the movie revealed later on that, well, she didn't.
Yeah.
She didn't look.
Heartbreaking. It's really sad.
It's horrible.
Yeah,
bloody dark.
Yeah.
So no wonder he's not perky.
Especially when she doesn't even remember the little keyring thing.
Yeah.
Gives her the little compass keyring.
Which to him is his entire world, and to her is just something.
She's like, what's this?
Yeah.
Oh. I thought the film had a lot of heart overall, actually. I think it had a really good few emotional scenes that I think that's something that the DC films are increasingly having. Like, Wonder Woman had so much heart, and Aquaman as well, despite everything going on. I think there were some kind of touching moments in there as well.
I mean, I love it.
I was really touched by the bongo playing octopus. I don't know, you guys
moved to tears.
Where did he touch you?
Everywhere. So many arms.
But it's true. I think what you were saying about tone is really interesting, because the trailers sort of led me to believe that this would be like a sort of DC's answer to Deadpool, you know, like it'd be sort of winky, knowing, ironic, sort of we're taking the piss out of the superhero genre. And there is elements of that, but I think it's, as much as anything, it's really earnest, and it's very sort of, they are going for that Amblin tone, and for that sort of, you know, big-hearted sort of fable.
Wasn't nearly as funny as I expected it to be.
No,
I'll be honest. Absolutely.
I did wonder if some of the jokes needed a bit of a punch up. Maybe there was a few that felt a bit first drafty, but there was, you know, it was like there was as much a sort of tragic drama, almost like tragic family drama, as it was a superhero comedy.
But there were some really nice jokes as well, like Freddy gets. I mean, that first one about, you know, being thrown out the window and stuff, and the, you know, I'm a disabled foster kid, you know, I've got it all. I mean, he's adorable. I also think the weirder you make little kids on film, the more adorable they are. So I really enjoyed Darla and Eugene and that whole sort of side of thing. I mean, Pedro and Mary got nothing really, but Darla and Eugene are adorable.
I think kids, you know, connect with that as well. I certainly connected with that as when I was a kid. If I watched a film in which a kid was a kind of, you know, straight down the middle kind of
hero.
I didn't gravitate towards that. No. If they were weird, like I was weird, then yes, please.
Absolutely.
More of that, please.
Yeah. And I loved like the scene with them in the going into the convenience store, trying to buy beer, being very excited that they can suddenly buy beer, and then having no idea what kind of beer to get, and then not liking it, because of course you don't, because it tastes like piss. So, and then just spending all their money on junk food instead. Yeah. I mean, I think I certainly can relate with that. I don't know about you, Chris, as a fellow teetotaler.
Yeah, absolutely. Beer tastes like piss. You heard it here first. It's just awful. It's awful.
Fun fact, the Romans used to brush their teeth with piss.
That was in the film.
Fun fact, beer actually tastes quite nice.
Oh, my God. Whatever, beer marketing board.
It's an acquired taste, isn't it?
It's an acquired taste.
The movies in the DCEU. Oh. That's a joke. Nice. That's a joke.
Nailed you.
As a joke.
You're going to get some angry letters now.
I know. I'm kidding. I like a lot of the movies in the DCEU. Phew. That headed them off at the pass, didn't it? Speaking of the DCEU, the end of the movie, and the very fact that this takes place so obviously in a world in which the Henry Cavill Superman and the Ben Affleck Batman are front and centre is interesting.
And I have a bit of a problem here, and I think I don't think it's malicious on anyone's part. I think it's just not particularly thinking about it at all. But so Freddy wears Superman and Aquaman t-shirts quite frequently through the film. He has obviously a batarang in his room. He has a Superman bullet. He has headlines, most of which appear to relate to Superman. There is a Wonder Woman doll on a shelf in the background in one shot precisely. But there's a whole lot of Batman and Superman stuff everywhere else. And I felt it was a bit weird that they were leaving out one of their more successful characters. I just thought it was a bit weird.
Yeah, I agree.
He had a t-shirt. He had a Wonder Woman t-shirt as well.
Who, Freddy?
Yeah.
When?
In a couple of the scenes, it's the W, and it's got the sword down the middle.
He's got the Aquaman one. I didn't see a Wonder Woman one.
He's got Aquaman
as well.
He's got a Wonder Woman one.
I didn't see that. Okay, fine.
Freddy seemed like the sort of proxy for the target audience, right? Like
isn't it? Why should the target audience only be male?
What I'm saying is maybe he's one of those people who, you know, moaned about Wonder Woman and how, you know,
no, he wouldn't be.
Women shouldn't have their own films.
Freddy would never. I like Freddy.
You never know.
They wear all over the toy shop, though, so that's something.
Yeah, that's true. And I really like the nod to Big in that scene as well. And I kind of wish that they had actually just started belting out Chopsticks on the piano. Isn't FAO Schwartz closed now in New York?
Yes, it is.
You can't go in there and do that anymore. So that was interesting. And I know that Philadelphia is it's the comic book thing as well. So so Philadelphia is the setting in the comic books as well. But it's weird. That was weird to me, if I'm honest, because the DC world, the DC universe, and the DCEU is so. It's almost like it's overlaid on top of ours, you know. But obviously, you have Central City, you have Gotham, you have Metropolis. So to have a real world city just jarred a little bit with me. And also to have Sly Stallone clearly existing in that world was also interesting. So does that mean that he's appeared in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 in this world? So my head is melting. It's just melting a little bit.
I don't know if there's a... I don't know if there's an MCU in the DCEU. Like, that would be weird, wouldn't it?
That'd be pretty funny.
Would you have liked... This is the question I opened up the interview with. Would you have liked, at any point, in all the different names that they bat around for Shazam, would you have liked Captain Marvel to be one of those names? Even just written down on a piece of paper as a kind of possibility.
Well, they had Zapped in America, so it's not that far off.
It's funny, Kim Newman, who wrote the review for this, I think he said on Twitter that there's two Captain Marvel movies out this year that don't mention the name Captain Marvel.
No, they don't.
It's so surreal.
Yeah.
And they're both out in the same, within a couple of months of each other.
Yeah.
I'm really confused why...
It's a hard title to get to.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not your obvious sort of... What shall we call you? I know, we shall call you Captain Marvel. Why would we do that?
I mean...
Where does that come from?
Shazam is equally stupid.
But Shazam is the wizard's name, and that sounds like a wizard's name to me.
He can never say his own name.
Yeah, he can never say his own name.
He can never say his own name.
He can never introduce himself.
Although I did actually like that moment in the final fight at the end where he kind of de-Shazams and then rolls under Mark Strong and then re-Shazams on the other side. It was quite cool.
But you could, surely I was thinking the easiest way to defeat Shazam is just to, put a stuff a rag in his mouth or something, you know,
getting really dark.
No, if you stop him from talking, then he can't.
But that's what they try. He tries with the drowning. Yeah.
But that's his kryptonite, isn't it?
So your suggestion, John? Let me just get this absolutely clear: to defeat Shazam, you want to kidnap a 14-year-old boy.
Yes.
Gag him.
Yes.
Possibly bind him.
Yep.
So he can't speak.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
I don't see any problems with that. No, I think that's totally fine. The Empire Podcast has long condoned that sort of behaviour.
No.
To be safe, we should gag
Chris,
all 14-year-olds.
No, again...
Like I always get condoned and condemned mixed up.
Condemned. Is the one you're looking for, yes.
We condemn that kind of behaviour. Don't do that at home. Okay, so let's talk about the end of the movie, the third act in which Billy's foster family... all become... I mean, what's the tactical term for this?
They're called the Shazam family.
The Shazam family? I can't even say that.
The Shazamly.
The Shazamly. Come on.
Oh, no.
That was one of their hashtags.
Was it?
Shazamly, yeah.
Okay, Shazamly. All right, well, I like that. Let's go with that. So they all turn into the Shazamly. And if you've heard the interview with David F. Sandberg and Peter Safran, you will know that the casting of Adam Brody and DJ Catrona was actually accidental. What do we think of that? I thought it was really, really nice that finally they got their superhero day in the sun.
That was great fun. I thought that was... To be honest, that was a genuine surprise. I didn't see it coming at all, and it was a really nice surprise. I just thought it was really fun. All the way through the film, I was actually thinking Freddy should have been the one to have got superpowers, and he thought so too. And so to actually
he's
have...
He's much more interesting.
he's like genuinely into superheroes. He's obsessed with them. And then to have his... it's literally wish fulfillment, isn't it? And that's so joyous. And I was thinking, if I was a kid watching this, and I was that kind of kid, I was like a superhero obsessed kid, and then suddenly his dreams come true. I mean, that's just like manna from heaven, isn't it? It's so much fun.
I think as well, Adam Brody is perfect casting for him as well. As an older Jack Dylan Grazer, they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
I think that's that was a really nice note, and especially Adam Brody being such a funny guy anyway.
Yeah. Having that motor mouth sort of...
Yeah, it just felt like a really strong fit. I really loved that moment where they all kind of get the powers, and when they all shout Billy instead of Shazam, really made me laugh. Say my name, Billy! But I do kind of wish that in that fight that they'd done a bit more... with them, and I don't think it was maybe made clear. I think that each of them has one of the powers.
Right.
He has all of the powers, but each of them gets one.
How does he get all the powers?
So I think Freddy can fly, Darla is super fast.
Pedro's super strong, obviously, because he's holding up the thingy.
Buffed up. But I feel like they didn't quite establish that.
No, that
clearly.
Was not made clear, because you do see Darla, she's at the top of the Ferris wheel at one point. So if she can't fly, I mean, she's got some extraordinary balance while she's going really fast.
I think
fast.
She was doing like a flash type thing of like, I'm running so fast that I can
I get it, but gravity still kind of applies. Mm. So I think that was not well communicated. I know that is the way it is in the comics, where, you know, he has everything and everybody else kind of gets...
That's unfair.
I know, it does seem
a bit unfair.
Unright, doesn't it? But I did kind of see that coming from the whole mention of my brothers and sisters used to occupy these thrones. I thought that was like, that would be cool. And I was frantically trying to match up the number of thrones and the number of kids. I think there's still one empty. It's all a bit Cair Paravel there at the end, isn't it? You know, a bit Narnia.
I think, yes.
There's seven thrones. He's got one in the middle and three on either side, and there's only six of them.
Yeah.
So there is room for somebody else to be added in,
who's
say, a sequel.
Who's that going
to
be? Who's that? And we do know there is going to be...
I don't think he's going to be taking one of the thrones if all goes well.
What would he turn into? Like a butterfly, maybe?
A beautiful butterfly.
Yes. So this Mr. Mind is, of course, the caterpillar that we glimpse in the very opening scene, and then who reappears in the mid-credit sting. He is a mutant caterpillar who has some telepathic powers and uses a voice box to speak.
Yeah, I also admire the chutzpah of having a post-credit sting on a DC movie featuring Mark Strong as the bad guy, given what happened with Green Lantern. Like, that's tempting fate, isn't it? To set up your sequel so blatantly with Mark Strong.
I think if they were worried about tempting fate, they wouldn't have cast Mark Strong as their bad guy. So I think that's okay. But I just have to read this bit out about Mr. Mind, who has been described as having the body of a lowly worm, the conscience of a Hitler, and the brain of a genius.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
That's also my Wikipedia entry.
Well, really? The brain of a genius? Really?
I think so, Helen.
Really?
Yeah.
I've just got to go and edit Wikipedia.
No, I just need to verify with an independent adjudicator, i.e. me, and yes, he has agreed that I, Chris Hewitt, is a genius.
Wow.
Okay, let's talk about where this... We talked about a little bit, then we got sidetracked, as we often do, about how this fits into the DCEU, and I'm really intrigued by the end of the movie. I think it's a lovely ending. I think having Superman, a.k.a. Zachary Levi's stunt double, thrust his frankly ludicrously muscled chest into the frame is a really nice touch. Ending on Superman, as you know from listening to the interview, Henry Cavill, there had been talks to have him cameo, didn't quite work out. Superman was meant to have dialogue in that scene. It was meant to finish, and I'm glad that they didn't. I'm glad that they finished this in this. But the question is, Cavill's on his way out as Superman. We know that. Ben Affleck's about to be replaced. They seem to be moving away from the team-based dynamic that was probably a bad idea in the first place. Build up these things using baby steps. So what does that end mean? Can there be another Superman in this universe, or are they all going to have to reboot?
Well, I don't think I don't think this one does have to reboot, does it, in order for that to reboot, because we haven't seen a face. So this one could quite neatly fit in with a new Superman without any problems. I think that the DCEU seems to have found its feet by each film doing their own thing, and by stopping putting sort of the cart before the horse, and that has been paying off for them. You know, you compare the absolutely disastrous box office of Justice League. I mean, okay, yes, 700 million just under would seem quite good for most films, but I'm sorry, for a Justice League movie, that's super bad.
Superbad actually did
much better. Right, Superbad did much better. Everybody go see Booksmart, which is coming soon. Anyway, my point is that I think they've actually found their feet by just focusing on each character and getting the tone for that each time. So Wonder Woman did brilliantly, Aquaman did brilliantly. I think this one's doing pretty darn well. So I think it seems to be a better approach.
I like that for us, the cameo is a bit of world building, it's tying things in, but it also works entirely within the context of the film and that character, that Freddy, his favourite superhero is Superman. That's his guy. Like, he's got... as much as he's got the Batarang, all of the headlines are Superman, he's got the bullet. So it's just a little fun note to end on, I think, that feels very tied in to the characters in this film, rather than just trying to be a bit of an olive branch to the rest of the universe.
Yeah, I'd hope that any future Shazam films, they stick to their own stories so much. I don't think Shazam would play well with the rest of the Justice League. I feel like he's his own beast.
It can be really good, though. Like, there's been a whole thing in the comics and the animated series at times when the Justice League and the Justice League juniors have been kind of... like, the Justice League proper have been worried about what we're going to do with all these superpowered teenagers in our command. And Shazam has volunteered to be in charge of them with generally disastrous results, because he's also a big kid, but they don't know that entirely. Anyway, it's really, really charming. There is a lot of potential for really fun stuff, especially if they introduce the sort of younger Justice League members.
I mean, a bit crazy having... I mean, Superman and Wonder Woman are already massively overpowered. Mm. And throwing Shazam into the mix, given that he is essentially Superman.
But this is the problem with all the DC characters.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you take the sort of, you know, the Green Lantern potentially is not that far off there as well.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Aquaman, at least in his element or near it, is not that far off. I mean, it's ridiculous how much power almost all of them have, and yet you have to give Batman something good to do because he's everybody's fucking favourite.
I'm good at DIY.
You know, it's just, it's they're all too powerful. And so I don't see that this makes any significant difference.
Too sexy?
That's probably true.
Sure.
Just one last thing, though. The fact that Superman shows up in this world actually made me a little bit sad that Henry Cavill appears to be on the way out. Because the way that the DCEU is evolving, and I don't mean that it's evolving in terms of it's moving towards an ultimate another Justice League movie, but the way that it's becoming slightly lighter and more fun, and the way that his Superman was towards the end of Justice League, I would have liked to see that Cavill Superman given a fair shot in a slightly lighter universe where it's not so grim dark all the time. That would be nice to see. Nice to see how he would have bounced off Zachary Levi, who I think, you know, we talked about the fact that he's not really playing Billy Batson. That's fine. He's playing an excitable, exuberant kid. He's terrific, though, isn't he?
Oh, he's fantastic. It's funny, actually, the comparisons to Big. His performance does remind me a little bit of Tom Hanks. He really gets those mannerisms and their sort of excitableness and slightly sort of jitteriness. And he's just a joy to watch. He's really fun. I think some of the best scenes in this movie are when they're exploring their superpowers, and there's a real just like sort of fizz to it all. And so much of that comes from his performance. I think he's brilliantly cast, even if perhaps not quite as matched to the younger Billy Batson.
Yeah, but then maybe his Shazam would have been a downer.
Yeah,
who knows?
I think there's just something about Zachary Levi as well that as soon as you see him, something about the energy of his performance, you immediately get who that character is. It feels a bit like, I don't know, when you saw Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, and you just go, within 2 minutes, you're like, cool, I get this. I get who this guy is. And I think he just seems like the ideal guy to play this role.
He's terrific. I love the scene in the convenience store where he's asking to be shot in the face. Yeah. It was just terrific. I was a little bit worried about bullet ricochets.
Yes.
Me too.
Yeah. Because, you know, take out the clerk or maybe smash Freddy in the face. And that's that. You don't want to do that halfway through your fun, feel-good, family-friendly superhero flick, do you?
That would be a bit darker. I really love the scene as well where they sneak out of school and he pretends to be his own dad or something.
He's just back from the business office.
So good.
And he's visibly wearing a light on his chest.
Yeah.
He's got a big coat on, though.
Yeah, because plenty of potential, I think, for a sequel.
Mm. I think, actually, for me, I can see him teaming up with the Justice League as the kind of, they're all proper adults and they have powers, but they're kind of the right mind to use them, whereas he's going to be blagging it the whole way because he's got all the powers, but he's a 14-year-old kid. Whereas I think a sequel, I'd be really intrigued to see what they do, because so much of the fun here is him testing the powers and the initial kind of, you're a kid and now you're a massive superhero. So I wonder what they would do with a sequel to kind of keep that newness and that energy coming.
One direction this is going to move in the future is obviously Black Adam. And there's a reference to Black Adam. I kind of missed it, but I think we see him earlier on whenever Shazam is talking about, he's talking through the history of Shazam and the wizard and all that sort of stuff. Apparently you see a Black Adam figure.
In like the hologram.
Yes, in the little... Yeah, okay, that's Black Adam.
That's Black Adam.
Mm-hmm. So the former champion who ruined everything by releasing the seven sins upon the world
is Black Adam.
Oh.
I did not realise that.
And he's been around for a really long time.
So there is going to be a Shazam 2. The screenwriter Henry Gayden, it was announced that he's going to be coming back for the sequel. And The Rock's been talking about the Black Adam movie. And I don't know whether Shazam would appear in that, or whether you'd want to see that, or whether you'd want to see Black Adam movie and then not even Shazam 2, but maybe a movie down the line where the two of them can either duke it out or duke it out for a while, then realize both their mums are called Shazama, and then they're fine.
I mean, any film where you've got Zachary Levi and The Rock together on the screen, I think would be a huge amount of fun. So,
Yeah,
that'd be great. Did you see Dwayne Johnson had a producer credit on this as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
I thought was an interesting sort of.
Well, because he's been involved for so long in the sort of Black Adam, and presumably the development of this as well.
Yeah. To be honest, I thought Black Adam had gone away.
I wasn't sure either, yeah. So they may have been waiting to see how people responded to this.
It'd be interesting to see where he fits in. Where, do you think he's being set up as a villain and then does the twist into anti-hero and gets his own movie? Or is he going to be the anti-hero from the start?
That would seem the logical way to do it for me. That would seem to have him, introduce him maybe as a villain in Shazam 2 and then spin him off. But presumably that's kind of the route that they've almost rejected by announcing a Black Adam movie. So I'm really confused by that. I don't know.
And it's weird to think of Dwayne Johnson as the baddie in someone else's movie as well, because he's sort of he's the biggest star in Hollywood.
Physically, yes.
That's how he started off, in fairness.
I guess, yeah.
So maybe. We shall see. But right now, that is it. On that note, we have to end our Shazam! ! Spoiler special. ! Our next spoiler special, I think
there's nothing really, is there? This big wasteland of releases.
Nothing in April.
Godzilla?
No, just
maybe Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Yeah. We might do one for that. Maybe Aladdin. I don't know.
Film out on April 25th or 26th. Eighth grade.
Our next spoiler special will be for Eighth Grade with the writer and director of that film, Bo Burnham. Hang on a second. Wait a minute. Although I would love that. That would be great. It's going to be Avengers Endgame. And
of course it is.
It's going to be us trying to make something work with some people who worked in the film, but I think it's probably going to be just the four of us, if that's your bag, sitting around a table, and maybe we'll try and beat the runtime. Maybe we won't. Let's see how it goes. But that's going to be Avengers Endgame. The regular podcast, in case you don't already listen and subscribe, is out every single Friday. And if you do listen and subscribe, if you could leave a lovely review on iTunes, that'd be great. Five stars? Give it 5 stars, you fuckers. That would be nice. That would be lovely. But until we meet again, until our next regular podcast or our next spoiler special, it is goodbye from John Nugent.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from Ben Travis.
Goodbye and back to the business office.
I like it. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
I would like to buy some of your finest beer, please. I'm kidding.
Beer tastes like piss.
Tastes good.
But was there a point when you thought it tastes like piss? Your first taste of beer.
Every first beer tastes like piss. But you have to get past that.
I want to offer you this option. You could just not.
Yeah.
No, I love beer now.
I love it. I've been conditioned. If you drink enough piss, does it start to taste like beer?
Yes.
This tastes like beer.
Every first piss tastes bad.
No.
What?
Oh my God.
No.
Especially if you're drinking straight from the tap.
Finish the podcast.
Oh, yes, please.
No. Please finish the podcast.
Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this family-friendly podcast. I've been Chris Hewitt. Thank you so much for listening. Magic 8-Ball says...
Outlook doesn't look good.
Not good. Bye-bye. Bye.